"Not so," he said, shaking his head in sadness. "Not so." Mark grabbed the remote and paused the recording.
"Who's Billie Holiday? I never heard of him."
"Her," said Jack.
"I don't know that song. I never heard of Strange Fruit."
"We know," his mother said softly. "We believe you."
Tucker took the remote, and with his push of the button, Highsmith continued. "On behalf of Jamal, his mama and daddy, the entire cousin family, and on behalf of the nearly 5,000 black men who were lynched in this country, I call on State Attorney Oliver Bolt and on all decent folk in Suwanee County to see to it that there is justice for Jamal. Justice without delay." Applause followed, and the screen went black. Tucker tossed the remote onto the couch.
"You see, Jack? He's not helping Jamal's family out of the goodness of his heart. He smells money."
"I didn't really get that," said Jack.
"The man says he wants justice. To him, justice means a quick guilty verdict against some frat boys at UF, followed by a multi-million-dollar wrongful death lawsuit against their families, which I can't pay, but the Robinson family surely can."
It wasn't unusual for clients to reach for conspiracy theories when facing criminal accusations. This one seemed pretty far afield. "Let's not get too ahead of ourselves," said Jack. There was a quick knock at the front door, but it was just Harry's way of announcing his return. He let himself in. His expression was noticeably grim as he approached.
"How'd it go?"
Tucker asked Harry.
"How did what go?"
asked Jack.
Elizabeth spoke just above a whisper.
"Your father went to visit Dick Waterston,"
she said, meaning the university president. Harry stepped farther into the living room, facing the others.
"I did what I could," said Harry. "The president's office will be issuing a press release at 1 o'clock.
Tucker put his arm around Mark's shoulder, seeming to know what Harry was going to say next.
"The text message is unacceptable student conduct," said Harry.
Jack watched as Tucker led his son toward the window, where Elizabeth joined them. The family turned away, their backs to the Switechs, as they gazed out the French doors toward the swimming pool. Harry delivered the final blow.
"Mark is being expelled from the University of Florida."
Mark's chin hit his chest. Elizabeth sobbed and hugged her son. Jack averted his eyes as Harry drew him toward the dining room, allowing the Towsons a moment in private. Harry spoke softly.
"The president isn't buying it that someone took Mark's phone at a frat party and sent that text to Jamal."
"I suspect there's more behind this decision than a text message," said Jack.
"I agree. I think the state attorney showed more evidence to the university than he's sharing with the media."
Harry glanced toward the Towson family.
"I feel terrible for Tucker and Elizabeth."
Jack nodded slowly, saying nothing, but keenly aware that the expression of sympathy had stopped with Mark's parents. The Towsons rejoined Jack and his father in the dining room.
"Can they really do this, Jack?"
asked Elizabeth.
"Just expel our son like this?"
"A student has a right to a hearing before being expelled," Jack said.
"But Mark needs to steer clear of that circus, in my opinion."
"Why?"
Jack addressed his response to Mark's parents.
"I can only imagine what the two of you are going through, but that's a discussion I should have alone with Mark."
"This is a family decision."
"It's really not," said Jack.
"Mark is my client. It's important that Mark feels that he can tell his lawyer anything. If he thinks everything he tells me goes straight back to his parents, that's not good. I hope you understand."
Tucker stepped away from his son, perhaps just to create the illusion of respect for the attorney-client relationship.
That's fine, Jack.
Take all the time you need. Say all the things that a lawyer has to say. But remember, your client is a Towson. He said, his gaze shifting toward his son. We don't go down without a fight. He'd clearly intended it as a rallying point, words of encouragement for his son, but it had fallen flat. Mark still looked numb. I'll keep that in mind, said Jack. Chapter 6. The mid-morning sun burned brightly over Live Oak. Cynthia Porter stepped out onto the covered front porch of her century-old house and settled into a white wicker chair. A paddle fan wobbled out of plumb above her. An orange cat jumped gently into her lap.
"Hello, Mrs. Butterscotch," she said sweetly.
Cynthia had lived in Live Oak since the FDR presidency, married 43 years to a stubborn man who died on the hottest day of the 20th century. The front lawn was half mowed when Bud Porter dropped to the freshly cut grass. Heart attack. Cynthia still owned the house on Pine Avenue where they'd raised a good son. It was a short walk from their church, and for 6 decades she'd rarely missed a Sunday service. That all changed with one misstep and an 8-inch fall from the curb, which had left her with a broken kneecap. As her arthritis worsened, she got around less. Since Christmas, church on Sunday had been more like once a month. She stroked Mrs. Butterscotch above her misty gray eyes and listened to the breeze. Live Oak had grown fivefold since Cynthia was a girl, to a population of 7,000. But the small town feel endured, and thanks to preservationists, some parts had changed not at all. The old saying, the more north you go in Florida, the more south you are, defined Live Oak. Workdays passed at the graceful pace of the Suwannee and Santa Fe rivers that bound it, and the inner peace of the Bible Belt filled each Sunday. But this was no ordinary Sabbath. Cynthia could hear crowd noises in the distance. She'd watched Mr. Highsmith's speech on television, and she'd heard him invite the townsfolk to march from their churches to the courthouse. The route from Mission Baptist led right past her house. The screen doors slapped shut, and her hired caretaker stepped onto the porch.
"You comfortable, Miss Cynthia?"
"Yes, I'm fine, Virginia."
Cynthia had hired a Negro, she still used the word, to move in and help her recuperate from the fall. The two women hit it off. The temporary arrangement was made permanent, and Virginia became her live-in caretaker and full-time companion. Virginia settled into the rocking chair and then pulled it a little closer to Cynthia. Somehow Virginia had gotten the idea that Cynthia's left ear was failing, but Cynthia insisted that there was nothing wrong with her hearing, even if the doctor did agree with Virginia.
"Hear the singing?"
asked Virginia. To Cynthia, it had been just noise in the distance.
"Is that what that is?"
Cynthia sat up straighter to look out over the porch rail as the crowd came into focus. Peaceful demonstrators, blacks and whites, approached from the south end of Pine Avenue. They marched several rows deep, arms locked in a show of unity that stretched from sidewalk to sidewalk. They walked past the bakery that made the best red velvet cake Cynthia had ever tasted, the salon where Cynthia had her hair done once a week, and the diner that, for the first half of Cynthia's life, was whites only.
"We shall overcome," Virginia sang softly, and only then did Cynthia realize what the demonstrators were singing.
Cynthia drew a breath.
"Sad,"
was all she could say. Virginia rose from the rocker and stepped to the rail. The crowd was just a block away in closing.
"That's Mr. Leroy Highsmith there in the front.
That must be Jamal Cousins' parents with him,"
They're here in Live Oak. I thought the boy's family was from Miami.
Probably come up for the body, said Virginia.
Poor mother.
I don't know how she can even stand up, let alone walk. Bless her heart.
Cynthia stared blankly into the middle distance.
Sad. Just makes me so sad.
The singing grew louder. Virginia returned to the rocker and pulled it even closer to Cynthia.
I can hear you just fine, said Cynthia.
Virginia smiled sadly, then joined in song as the demonstrators passed. It seemed prophetic that the verse had just rolled over to the promise of walking hand in hand someday. Virginia reached over the white wicker armrest and clasped Cynthia's hand. It wasn't the first time the women had held hands, but this felt different. A complicated mix of emotions coursed through her 90-year-old veins as the chorus of unity marched on toward the Suwanee County Courthouse, as Cynthia's mind clouded with memories. Cindy hurried inside the house, and the ornaments rattled on the Christmas tree as the front door slammed behind her.
Cindy?
Her mother called from the kitchen.
I'm home,
she announced, and then she ran upstairs as fast as her 15-year-old legs would carry her. She went straight to her room, locked the door, and jumped onto her bed. School was out till January, but Cindy's father had her take a job over the break to help Mrs. Dot at the dime store. Mr. Dot was overseas with the army for the second consecutive Christmas. Cynthia's younger cousins were counting the days till Santa's arrival, just two more, but for most of Live Oak, it was a subdued holiday season, tempered by the war effort. The employee gift exchange had been especially understated.
Cards only, Mrs. Dot had insisted.
The employees had gathered in the front of the store for about 15 minutes after closing. Mrs. Dot served cookies and eggnog, and Cindy gave a card to each of her co-workers. All but one had reciprocated at the party. All but one had been welcome at the party. Willie James was the only black employee at Van Priest's. It would have been a terrible breach of Southern code for him to attend. He would have been equally out of line to give a holiday card to the daughter of a white man of status, a former state legislator who ran the local post office. What surprised her, however, wasn't that he'd been so presumptuous. The surprise was her own feelings when he'd come up to her afterward, away from the others, and slipped the envelope into her hand.
Merry Christmas,
he said in that velvet voice. She smiled again as she reopened the envelope and read once again, a fifth time, the way he'd signed it. With L was what he'd written. With love was what he'd meant.
Cynthia!
Her father was in the hallway right outside her bedroom. To him, she was always Cynthia, especially if she was in trouble. The crystal doorknob jiggled, but the lock kept him out.
Cynthia, open this door!
Miss Cynthia?
She felt Virginia squeeze her hand, which cleared away the memories.
You was asleep with your eyes open, Miss Cynthia. You okay?
Cynthia's gaze drifted up Pine Avenue where the crowd continued on toward the courthouse.
Yes,
she said softly.
I'll be fine.
Chapter 7 Jack borrowed Tucker Towson's pickup truck, dropped his father at the Gainesville airport, and continued on to Live Oak alone. Oliver Bolt had agreed to a 1:30 p.m. meeting with Jack at his office. Jack would have liked to confer with the lawyers for Cooper Bartlett and Bain Robinson beforehand, but neither family had decided on a lawyer. Denial. Jack spoke to Bain's father and Cooper's mother by phone, assured them that this was not going to blow over, and even recommended attorneys to contact. But Mark was already facing expulsion, and Jack couldn't wait for the others to get their acts together. Although the crisis was a little more than 12 hours old, it was impossible to overstate the importance of opening a dialogue with the prosecutor before the high-speed train of public opinion left the station. The drive was just over an hour, mostly on the interstate, with not much to see. Jack de-stressed by counting billboards. The unofficial tally, life begins at conception, 22, we bear all, 21. As Jack exited I-75 and crossed the city limits, the billboards gave way to red, white, and blue yard signs along quiet residential streets. Re-elect Oliver Bolt, your state attorney. A 21st century lynching was explosive by definition. A state attorney up for re-election was like gasoline on the fire. The office of the state attorney was in a generic bank building on Court Street, directly across from one of the most beautifully restored courthouses in Florida. Built in 1904, the Suwanee County Courthouse was a piece of history, and an architectural gem that commanded passers-by to stop and admire. Perhaps Jack was just missing his family, or perhaps it was the scourge of one too many Riley road trips to Disney World, but Jack couldn't help thinking that the old courthouse would have fit perfectly on the theme park's faux turn-of-the-century Main Street. It was tempting to label Live Oak a time capsule, but walking from his car, Jack immediately noted a sign of change. A law office marquee that read, Attorneys, Abogados.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Switek, said Bolt.
Jack was in the state attorney's corner office. With them was senior trial counsel, Marsha Weller.
Marsha will be the lead prosecutor on this case, Bolt added.
Bolt was at least 10 years older than he appeared in his campaign posters. His face was fuller, his hair was thinner, the creases in his brow were more pronounced, and his teeth were not as white. Weller was about Jack's age, which meant that this was far from her first murder case, though everyone in the room understood that this was a case like no other.
How can we help you? Asked Weller.
Jack told them what they already knew, that his client was facing expulsion from the university for sending a racist text message to Jamal Cousin, and then added what they needed to know. My client didn't send it.
The university seems to disagree, said Bolt.
There's been no hearing yet.
Is your client planning to testify at the hearing? Asked Bolt.
That depends, said Jack. I don't know of many lawyers who would advise a client to testify at a school disciplinary proceeding while he's the target of an active homicide investigation.
Bolt paused to measure his response. No one is saying that your client is a target, Mr. Switek.
And no one is saying that he's not,
Weller added.
Well,
pardon my confusion, said Jack.
But I drove up here to look you in the eye and get a direct answer to a direct question. Is Mark Towson a target?
The prosecutors exchanged glances, and then Bolt answered,
We're not at liberty to discuss the status of an active investigation.
Let's go at this a different way, said Jack.
Whether you admit it or not, the university is following your lead.
So tell me.
What do I need to do to convince you that Mark Towson didn't send that text?
Bolt leaned back in his desk chair, considering his response. An interview would be a good start.
You already questioned Mark in Gainesville.
He terminated the interview before Detective Proctor was finished.
It was 1 o'clock in the morning and he had no lawyer. And even then, Mark told you he didn't send it.
Well, said Bolt, stretching a single syllable into a deeply southern wail, the boy wasn't under oath.
If my client swore on a stack of Bibles that he didn't send that text, would it make a difference to you? Bolt glanced at his lead prosecutor once more as if conferring in silence. Weller took the cue.
"There's one thing that might make a difference, Mr. Switek," she said. "Would your client sit for a polygraph?" Bolt followed up, seeming to like his chief prosecutor's suggestion.
"We could limit it to one question. Did you send the text to Jamal Cousin?"
Jack wasn't a believer in polygraphs. He'd seen too many guilty men pass and too many innocents fail. But a flat refusal would only raise suspicions.
"Who conducts the examination?" asked Jack.
"The Suwanee County Sheriff's Office," said Weller.
"That won't work," said Jack.
"It would have to be someone we both agree on."
"How about the Florida Department of Law Enforcement?"
"It can't be anyone currently working in law enforcement," said Jack. "I need some assurance of objectivity. Someone in private security."
"We won't agree to that," said Bolt.
"Why not?"
"Because our examiners are fully qualified and fair." "What are you afraid of?"
"Let's not do this dance," said Jack. "Even if we could agree on an examiner, neither one of us will accept the results if they don't go our way."
"That's pretty cynical," said Bolt.
"There's a reason no court in the history of American jurisprudence has ever found the results of a lie detector test to be admissible at trial."
"Well," Bolt said again, "if your client won't consent to an interview or a polygraph examination, there's not much for us to talk about."
"I said I wouldn't agree to a polygraph on your terms." "No lawyer would."
"Bain Robinson's lawyer might."
Last Jack had heard, Bain Robinson had yet to hire a lawyer. "Are you bluffing me, Mr. Bolt? I spoke to Bain's father less than an hour ago, and he said Bain doesn't have a lawyer yet."
"He does now. I just got off the phone with him 5 minutes ago. Leonard Odin. One of the finest lawyers in all these parts. I'd expect no less. The Robinson family is quite well-to-do."
"So I've heard," said Jack. The state attorney checked his watch.
"Tell you what, Mr. Switek, why don't you and Mr. Odin confer and get back to us? Maybe we can line up both your clients for that lie detector."
"I wouldn't count on that," said Jack.
"Then it's been a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Switek," Bolt said.
On his lead, they rose and ended the meeting with a handshake. Weller walked Jack to the lobby and shifted the conversation to Jack's father, whom she claimed to have voted for some 20 years earlier.
"Stressful time around here, I would imagine," said Jack. "Just a few weeks to the election."
"Oliver said it in his press conference this morning, and he meant it. There will be no rush to justice."
The prosecutor wished him well as she unlocked the door and let him out of the building. Jack was walking to his car, cell phone to his ear, when Tucker Towson answered his call.
"How did the meeting with the state attorney go?"
asked Tucker. Jack wished he could say great. He went with fine. But he wasn't out of ideas.
"I know a retired FBI agent in Miami who works in private security. She specializes in polygraph examinations, and I trust her. Would you be willing to fly her up to Gainesville to test Mark? I could probably get her to do it for around $500 plus the plane ticket."
"You want to give Mark a lie detector test?"
"I haven't decided. I might."
"But what if he fails?"
It was a predicament that Jack had faced before.
"Then we don't make the results public."
"I guess that makes sense. Go ahead then, line her up."
"Thanks."
"And oh, Jack."
"Yeah?"
"When I asked, what if Mark fails, I wasn't implying... Well, I just don't want you to get the impression that I have reason to think he wouldn't pass."
"I understand, but let me ask you a question, Tucker, and I want an honest answer."
"Sure."
Jack stopped at his car, standing at the parking meter. "Do you have reason to think that Mark won't pass?" There was a brief silence on the line, and Jack wasn't sure if Tucker was simply taken aback by the question, or if he actually needed the time to consider his response.
"Nope,"
he said finally, adding a little chuckle, as if the answer was obvious.
"None whatsoever."
"That's good to hear," said Jack as he unlocked the car door.
"Tell Mark I'll call him from the interstate."
Chapter 8 Leroy Highsmith reached across the kitchen table, joined hands with Edith and Lamar Cousin, and led them in prayer. He prayed for their son Jamal, for the family, and for an end to racism.
"In Jesus' name, amen."
On the table beside their clasped hands lay a copy of the press release from the University of Florida's president, announcing the immediate expulsion of Mark Towson. The hateful, disgusting text message from Mr. Towson to fellow student Jamal Cousin has no place at our great university. While I am in no way prejudging the criminal investigation into the murder of Jamal Cousin, we must have zero tolerance for blatant bigotry and racism.
Amen.
Jamal's parents said in unison. The Cousin family had been in Highsmith's hands since Saturday afternoon. It was Highsmith who'd accompanied Jamal's father to the morgue, and it was Highsmith who'd kept Edith from falling to the floor when Lamar stepped out and told her, "Dear God, honey, it's him." Highsmith had arranged for their overnight stay with his friends in Live Oak, where they'd awakened on Sunday morning to the harsh realization that it wasn't just a terrible nightmare. They were living it.
"Mr. Highsmith, can I speak to you in private for a moment?"
Standing in the doorway was Quinton Press, the brightest star in the cast of talented young lawyers at the Highsmith firm. Quinton accompanied his boss wherever he went and was the odds-on favorite to become the firm's next partner. Highsmith excused himself from the table and followed Quinton down the hallway and out onto the front porch. If Quinton's plan had been to speak to Highsmith alone, it failed, miserably.
"Looks like the media figured out where we're staying," said Quinton.
At the press conference following the church-to-courthouse march, Highsmith had asked the media to give the Cousin family some space. The response was a forest of mobile transmission towers, outside broadcast vans, and TV crews parked on the street in front of what was supposed to have been an undisclosed place of retreat. They respected the property line, at least, firing questions across the front yard from the edge of the pavement.
"Mr. Highsmith, how's the family doing? Is the expulsion enough?"
Highsmith waved without comment, but no. Expulsion was not enough. Sure, the president had also directed the Office of Equal Opportunity to investigate whether Mr. Towson's text message was an isolated action or part of systematic racism by a white fraternity. But Highsmith knew what that meant. Damage control. It was the typical university doublespeak when it came to the three R's, rape, racism, and recruiting violations.
"To the garage," he told Quinton.
The possible involvement of three white college students in a modern-day lynching had pushed the news coverage way beyond facts, even beyond speculation. Since 5 a.m., every development and possible future development had been picked apart by pundits, analyzed by trial lawyers, and debated by civil rights activists on television. Only occasionally was it mentioned that the sheriff had yet to announce an arrest.
"They hired Governor Switek's son," said Quinton.
They were alone in the one-car garage, standing on an oil stain that was as big as an area rug, at least half a century in the making.
"Thank God they picked a lightweight," said Highsmith.
"How soon till an arrest?"
"Miss Weller says she doesn't know."
"Bullshit. Quinton, I can't confer with Oliver Bolt every 2 hours. He doesn't have time, and neither do I. But he promised me that Marsha Weller would keep the family updated. You have to press her.
I did. Quinton checked his notes on his tablet. She said that Bolt want zero lag time between arrest and indictment, so there will be no arrest until they're ready to take the case to the grand jury.
That's lame. This isn't opening night on Broadway. Any half-assed prosecutor can get an indictment just by asking for it. Really. It doesn't take much more than that.
They need to bolster the evidence on motive.
Motive?
Technically, motive is not an element of the crime of homicide, but in any murder case, motive is important. Highsmith stepped away, breathing out his anger.
This isn't a fucking murder case!
Excuse me? His anger was turning to energy. He paced from one end of the garage to the other, then looked the young lawyer in the eye.
You don't get it, do you, Quinton?
Get what, sir?
Millennials, he said, almost spitting out the word. An entire generation of entitled motherfuckers. You and everyone your age think it's normal that a black superstar athlete gets a $70 million shoe contract. You think it's normal that a smart black kid gets into Harvard.
I really don't know what...
Black folk died to make that happen, Quinton. There's no motive to figure out here. This is not a murder case.
Quinton blinked, confused. Then, what is it?
It's all the hell with it. If you don't get it, no way you're gonna make a 60-year-old white man from Live Oak understand. I'll do it myself, like everything else around here.
Highsmith checked his reflection in the garage window and exited through the side door. Just the sight of him sent reporters running for their microphones, cameras rolling.
Mr. Highsmith!
He crossed the lawn at a deliberate pace and stopped just before the pavement. Questions came from too many directions, so he quickly found a camera from a national news organization and spoke directly to it, ignoring any single reporter.
I have a quick statement on behalf of the cousin family, he said, and the crowd hushed to listen. Jamal's parents wish to thank everyone across the country for their prayers and love. They are appreciated. Jamal was their only child, their pride and joy, and this is unimaginably painful for them. But it's important for you, I mean the media, to understand how this loose talk about a gruesome murder involving frat boys is adding to their pain. Let me speak clearly about this. First, whoever committed this despicable act is not a frat boy, a schoolboy, a homeboy, or any other kind of boy. They are men who enjoy the position of privilege because men and women, even younger than they are, many of them of color, fight and die for this country. Second, and I am speaking to you, Mr. State Attorney, lynching has never been about the murder of one man or one woman. The crime here is terrorism. Racial terrorism. The victim is the entire African-American community. And the motive is hate. Jamal Cousin was president of the preeminent Black Greek Letter organization at Florida's flagship university. Lynching him on the banks of the Suwannee River, where he would be found by African-American students, is an act of terrorism. And no matter how privileged these terrorists deserve your sympathy, no more than the Boston Marathon bombers or the Orlando nightclub shooter. That is all, he said, ignoring the cacophony of follow-up questions as he turned and walked back to the house. Quinton met him at the porch steps. You get it now, Quinton?
They continued up the steps and crossed the porch.
I think so.
You think so?
He opened the front door, allowing his boss to enter first.
I do, he said, following Highsmith inside. I definitely do.
Chapter 9.
Jack ignored the speed limit all the way back to Gainesville and headed straight to the Theta House. The latest buzz on social media was that police were headed to the fraternity with a search warrant. The state attorney had yet to return Jack's call to confirm or deny the rumor, which only made Jack believe it was true. It was important that he be there, but he hadn't planned on a street clogged with demonstrators. A traffic cop stopped him 8 blocks from Fraternity Row. Jack rolled down his window to plead for passage.
"Campus is closed to vehicles," said the officer. "I have to get to the Theta House."
"Yeah, you and everyone else."
"I'm the attorney for Mark Towson, Theta president."
"And I'm the Easter Bunny. Move along." Jack didn't have time to argue. He parked off campus and started down the sidewalk, dialing his client for an update. Mark was still with his parents at home, without a cell phone but available on the landline, and his friends at the fraternity house were keeping him posted.
"Cops just got there and are moving everyone to the dining room," said Mark. "Looks like they want to search upstairs."
Jack broke into a run, speaking urgently into his phone.
"Who's your contact in the frat?"
"Cooper Bartlett. Bane's with him. Should I be there too?"
"No," Jack said, huffing with each footfall. "And tell your friends to say nothing to the police."
Jack tucked away his cell and continued at full speed for another 2 blocks, flying past groups of students who were on their way to the protest on Fraternity Row. The crowd swelled as he got closer to the Theta House, forcing him to slow down and weave his way through demonstrators. It was a mix of students, half blacks and half other races, which by Jack's quick estimate meant that most of UF's 50,000 students had stayed home, but its 3,000 African-American students had come out in force. The collective mood was somewhere between anger and dissatisfaction with the university's decision to expel just one fraternity member, even if he was the president. Banners and posters made the point, and the message was clearest as Jack pushed his way closer to the house, where hundreds of students, black and white, wore white t-shirts in solidarity, each with the Greek letters of Jamal's fraternity emblazoned on the front and a handwritten message on the back. "Black Lives Matter" was a common refrain, along with "Theta Pi Omega hates me." A black student with a handheld loudspeaker was standing atop a red brick wall that ran adjacent to the crowded sidewalk. Jack recognized him from the news as the fraternity brother on the Itchituckney tubing trip who had found Jamal's body, Percy Donovan.
"We have a message for you, President Waterston!" Percy shouted, the loudspeaker carrying his voice above the crowd. "We will not sit quietly for another investigation into systemic racism that goes nowhere. We will not accept the same old excuse that this is another isolated incident. Racist cowards never act alone. TPO must go. TPO must go."
With fist pumping, he spurred on the crowd, the rhythmic chant beating like the new pulse of Fraternity Row.
"TPO must go."
Jack pushed forward, where a line of uniformed police officers kept the crowd from hopping the wall and setting foot on the Theta front lawn. Jack approached the cop with the grayest hair, someone old enough to recognize the unusual name Switek as that of the former governor. It worked. The officer escorted him around the house to the rear entrance. 6 cars were parked directly behind the house, and a posted sign gave notice that each space was reserved for an elected officer, from president to sergeant-at-arms. A team of forensic agents from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement had descended on Mark's car, doors, trunk, and hood wide open as the active search of the vehicle was underway. Jack identified himself and asked to see the warrant, which one of the officers produced. The state attorney had yet to identify Mark Towson as a target of the investigation, but the warrant left little doubt as to the focus. The search was for an 8-cord nylon rope of any length.
"I assume that's the type of rope used in the murder of Jamal Cousin," said Jack.
The officer was under no obligation to reply, And he didn't. Jack moved to the second item listed in the warrant. Fibers from a cotton shirt and denim jeans.
And I presume the fibers are consistent with the clothing that Jamal was wearing?
No reply.
How did you get into the vehicle?
Asked Jack.
Break the locks?
No. The Theta House mother turned over a set of keys at our request. They are kept inside the house.
For the record, my client does not consent to a search for any item not listed in the warrant. And he does not consent to the search of any place not described in the warrant.
Understood?
But you should check the other warrants.
There's more than one?
Yep,
the officer said, signaling with a jerk of his head.
Inside.
Jack started toward the house, and as he opened the door, a reporter called out his name. Jack stopped and looked. She was on the other side of the wall with her cameraman.
Is Mark Towson a suspect?
She shouted. The media had been piecing things together all day, quick to label just about anything breaking news. A police search of the Theta president's car was the holy grail. Jack stepped inside, closed the door, and called the Towson's landline. His client answered.
Just stay where you are until I get back, Mark.
This ride is about to get bumpier. Chapter 10. Leroy Highsmith left for the Suwanee County Airport, 2 miles outside of Live Oak, late Sunday afternoon. Quentin Press drove, and the parents of Jamal Cousin rode with them. The pilot greeted them on the tarmac.
We're good to go, Mr. Highsmith. I should have you in Miami within the hour.
Thank you, Jordan.
The Legal Eagle, a twin-engine private jet, was the largest aircraft the Suwanee Airport could accommodate, and it was perhaps the most obvious symbol of Highsmith's rags-to-riches success. Over his 4-decade career, Highsmith had been featured in countless platforms, from the Wall Street Journal and Vanity Fair to 60 Minutes and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. His parents were sharecroppers on white-owned land near Lake Okeechobee, and their 9 children grew up in a shanty town of whitewashed shacks with tar paper roofs. Somehow, their youngest son went on to become the first lawyer ever from Belglade, a town so third world that the Peace Corps used to train its volunteers there. It was the riches, however, that drew the media's attention. More than 100 verdicts and settlements in excess of $1 million paid for a 50-room mansion in the mostly white enclave of Palm Beach, and filled his 8-car garage with a fleet of European-made automobiles, including 4 Bentleys and 2 Aston Martins. In addition to the 41 talented lawyers who worked for him, he had his own manager, publicist, social media consultant, chef and sous chef, relaxation therapist, financial advisors, private investigators, pilots, and aviation mechanics. Some said he traveled to court in a limousine so long that the back end arrived 5 minutes after the front end, while others wrote more accurately about his $15,000 suits, custom-made crocodile shoes, and a bejeweled Rolex wristwatch. And there was one nugget that made it into every story. The 18-carat gold fixtures in his Gulfstream G550.
Is that real gold?
Asked Mrs. Cousin. She hadn't asked on the trip up from Miami, but Highsmith knew that she would eventually. Black folks always asked. White folks never did. They just sat quietly and assumed it was the typical black man's expression of in-your-face arrogance, harking back to the days of the great Jack Johnson, who capped his front teeth in gold as he knocked out one white fighter after another on his way to becoming the first black heavyweight boxing champion of the world. Highsmith could only imagine what his white guests said about him and the privacy of their automobile on the way home from the airport. And then he just loved their reaction when days later he would tell them that he'd purchased his Gulfstream pre-owned from a white businessman, gold fixtures included.
You'll want to take this call,
said Quentin as he handed Highsmith his cell phone.
It's Oliver Bolt.
Highsmith excused himself from the cousins, then moved from the main seating area of the cabin to the forward compartment on the other side of the galley, where he could speak in private.
Hello, Oliver,
he said in a pleasant tone.
I saw your speech on television,
said the state attorney.
Those were some very hurtful words. You deserved a good kick in the ass. If you're looking for motive, you're dragging your feet. Dragging? Come on, Leroy. It's been 2 days.
Which will turn into 2 weeks, then 2 months, and then nothing. I can smell it.
You're not being fair. And I don't just mean the speech. The fact that Jamal's parents came to Live Oak and never met with the state attorney is terrible optics. They met with the medical examiner, the lead homicide detective, and the prosecutor you've assigned to the case. That's enough.
It makes me look like an insensitive jackass. Or worse, a racist.
I want to meet them.
Not this trip, they're exhausted.
That's because you marched them all the way from Mission Baptist to the courthouse.
They've met everyone but me. Let me spell it out for you, Oliver. I will not put these grieving parents through another meeting and more agony just so you can have a photo op to boost your campaign for re-election.
This has nothing to do with politics, Bolt said, his voice rising. I've never lost an election in my life, and I'm not worried about this one.
Highsmith paused, not because he was without words, but because he wanted them to have the intended effect.
Maybe you should be worried, Oliver.
There was silence on the line, and then the state attorney spoke, incredulous.
Did I just hear you correctly?
It's an observation, not a threat. I have no mind to work against you. You're a decent man, but you are more detached from the black voters of Suwanee County than you know.
Maybe that's because in past elections black folk didn't vote.
They will this time. If there's no indictment before the first Tuesday in November, you could find yourself out of work on Wednesday.
This investigation has my full attention. There are things in the works that I can't share with you. I called you for one reason, to meet with Jamal's parents.
And you will meet them, as soon as there's an indictment.
Good night, Oliver.
Highsmith ended the call and tossed the phone onto the leather seat next to him. His associate brought him a scotch on the rocks and placed it on the armrest. Highsmith raised an eyebrow which sent Quentin running for a napkin.
So sorry,
he said upon his quick return. Highsmith sipped his scotch as his associate wiped the beads of condensation from the gold-plated trim on the armrest. Chapter 11 Jack moved quickly through the Theta House. The officer at the bottom of the main staircase produced a second warrant for the search already underway upstairs. Jack read it and immediately called Tucker.
I need you to make a list of every store between here and the Itchituckney River that sells 8-cord 3/4-inch yellow nylon rope.
Is that what they're searching the house for? Asked Tucker.
Just Mark's car. The house warrant is limited to computers, Mark's, Bain's, and Cooper's.
Why not the rope?
Because we're obviously dealing with a savvy prosecutor. If they find rope in Mark's car and it matches the murder weapon, it's a home run. But if they search the entire house and find nothing, that would give the defense something to crow about. It's a calculated risk on the part of the state attorney.
A young man called to him,
Mr. Swiatek?
From the top stair. Jack ended the call with Tucker and headed up. It was Mark's friend Cooper Bartlett.
They just finished in my room,
he told Jack. Is your lawyer here?
I don't have one.
You need one.
I know, said Cooper.
My parents are divorced, and my dad says if I need money for a lawyer, I should sell my car.
You don't happen to know an attorney who wants an 8-year-old Miata with 80,000 miles, do you?
What kind of father? Jack began to wonder, then stopped. He'd seen even bigger deadbeats.
Cooper, you need a lawyer right away.
My mom's working on it.
Where's Bain?
In his room, with his lawyer.
Jack had called Leonard Oden on the drive back from Live Oak, but received no reply. He was eager to meet him. And not just to get some clarity as to his position on Bain's polygraph examination. He continued down the hallway, where another officer was posted outside the open door to Bain's room. Jack introduced himself to the officer, which drew Bain and his attorney out of the room. Jack's mouth opened, but his words were on a several-second delay.
Leonard Oden, the lawyer said, as he handed Jack a business card. And yeah, dude, I'm black.
Jack felt a tinge of embarrassment, but Oden seemed to have anticipated his surprise. Jack hoped he had a sense of humor.
Jack's Wytek, and no, dude, I'm not.
That drew a hint of a smile. A hallway in the presence of a Gainesville police officer was no place to talk further. Oden ducked back into his client's room to oversee the search. 15 minutes later, Jack did the same in his client's room. By then, Cooper Bartlett's lawyer had shown up. The three attorneys met in the study, which, if cleanliness was any indicator, was the least used room in the fraternity. Oden struck Jack as more than capable. A former public defender whose practice was entirely criminal defense. Cooper's lawyer, however, gave Jack concern. Edward Post called himself a trial lawyer, which in the legal lexicon could mean anything from Clarence Darrow to the parking ticket repairman. 2 minutes into the meeting, Jack was leaning toward the latter.
You need to fight this expulsion, said Post. The university can't make it stick.
Jack would have liked to focus the discussion on the lynching, but the lawyers were still in the getting-to-know-each-other stage. Talking about the text from Mark's phone was like dipping the big toe into cold river water, testing things out.
It's a preponderance of the evidence standard, said Jack. If the conduct committee finds it more likely than not that Mark sent the text, the expulsion stands.
Post looked at Jack as if the guy from Miami just didn't get it.
It's constitutional law 101.
I don't think so.
Let me give you a little history, said Post. September 26, 2013. Around 1:30 a.m., a black female student walks past UF's oldest and biggest fraternity. One of the frat boys sitting on the front porch yells out racial, sexually charged insults. What punishment do you think the university handed down?
Something less than expulsion, if I take your drift, said Jack.
Cultural education, said Post. The dean of students told the Gainesville Sun that as reprehensible as the behavior was, it is protected by the First Amendment as free speech. So, it would be illegal to punish him.
That's different, said Jack.
Threatening to kill someone is never protected speech. Threatening to lynch a man because he's black is even worse. It's a hate crime under Florida law, a first-degree felony. We're talking mandatory prison time. Mark's defense is that he didn't send the text. Not that it was his constitutional right to send it.
Oden agreed. And Mark also has the football factor working against him.
The football factor? Asked Jack.
President Waterston announced the expulsion less than 30 minutes after Devin Claiborne tweeted that his father wants him to decommit from UF.
Who's Devin Claiborne? Asked Jack.
Senior at Booker T. High School. Number one quarterback in the nation.
What does that have to do with the expulsion hearing?
Everything, said Odin. If you win that hearing, UF loses a future Heisman candidate who can deliver this university its first national championship since Urban Meyer was head coach. I don't care how many constitutional rights you try to wrap around your client. There's only one top recruit in the nation. Only one Devon. So you're saying, I'm saying Mark Towson doesn't have a prayer. It sounded too cynical, but it had Jack thinking. I hope you're wrong. The discussion turned to the search warrants. Seizure of the computers was not unexpected, and they agreed that virtually anybody could have yellow nylon rope in his car or garage, or his fraternity. Still, it wouldn't be a good thing if the search turned up rope that matched the one used in the lynching. The situation was still too fluid for Jack to talk freely, however, and each lawyer was understandably guarded in his remarks, except to say that his client had nothing to do with the murder of Jamal Cousin. Cooper's lawyer checked his watch repeatedly and left the meeting precisely at the top of the hour. Jack surmised that Cooper's deadbeat dad had agreed to pay for 1 hour of attorney time, not a minute more. The door closed and Jack turned the conversation to something he'd been waiting since his meeting with the state attorney to discuss alone with Bain's lawyer.
Oliver Bolt wanted Mark to submit to a polygraph, said Jack. I told him no, but he said you and Bain were considering it.
Odin burst into laughter.
What's so funny? Asked Jack.
Jack, I never said anything to Oliver Bolt about a polygraph. That never even came up. The chant of demonstrators outside the house grew louder. TPO must go. Jack spoke over it.
So Bolt lied to me?
Why are you so surprised? This can't be your first rodeo with a country lawyer.
Far from it.
Bolt took a big bite out of your big city attitude, chew that shit up, and spit in your face. Politely, of course. It's the aw shucks good old boy style. They're all the same.
No, they're not, said Jack.
Odin removed his eyeglasses, as if Jack needed a better look at his face.
They are if you look like me.
Jack didn't have an immediate response, and Odin didn't wait for one. He rose and shook Jack's hand.
Looking forward to working beside you, Jack. This is gonna be interesting.
Yeah, said Jack. Good word for it.
Chapter 12. Jack expected a funereal atmosphere inside the Townsend home. Instead, he found Mark's father almost bouncing off the walls with renewed energy.
Jack, so glad you're back, Tucker said, as he took him by the arm and led him inside. I want you to meet Candace.
Candace who? Asked Jack.
Candace Holder, she said as she emerged from the kitchen. Holder was a tall, well-dressed African-American woman who looked like she just stepped off a news set.
President and founder of Holder Images and Media Relations.
You hired a PR firm? Asked Jack.
Course not, Tucker said with a chuckle. I could never afford Candace.
I'm here to give Tucker a few tips, she said. Tucker and I worked together in the governor's office. I was communications director for your father during his first term.
The first term, when Jack was at the Freedom Institute and Harry Swiatek was signing more death warrants than any governor in Florida history. The dark days when Jack and his father weren't speaking.
Elizabeth stepped out of the master bedroom, then stopped and turned like an awkward runway model.
Holder raised an eyebrow in disapproval.
I'm sorry, honey. That dress and those pearls are way too Paula Deen. Negative association. The last thing we need is for folks to look at you and be reminded of a woman who went down in flames for using the N-word. If there's nothing else in that closet, we're going shopping.
Elizabeth sighed, clearly exasperated. Jack was tired, but Elizabeth looked beyond exhausted, almost ill.